This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 660.
Fuck yeah. Wait, we stopped at 60. I'm just excited for 666. I got so stoked that I stopped listening to you to celebrate. It was like a touchdown pass right before.
You jumped ahead a little bit.
My brain just goes to the devil so quickly.
I'm so sorry, Kyle.
No, it's all right.
Or, you know what, though? It seems to be working out great for you.
Our Dark Lord will forgive me, so.
Do we have anything from the Nerdist Community Corkboard?
Somebody sent a remix of that. I got to forward that to you.
Please do.
It's a good time. This one, I almost want to just go to. In Portland, Tennessee.
Yes.
They're having the Strawberry Festival that they have annually in that town.
Fantastic.
Only this year it's being invaded by the 501st Stormtrooper Brigade.
What?
And the Grand Marshal of the Berry Parade is the one and only Darth Vader.
Now, I've been given a special certificate from the 501st.
Really?
And they're a good group.
Did they make you like a lieutenant, like, you know, like when you get deputized?
Well, yeah,
can you murder rebel scum?
I can murder rebel scum.
That's right.
But I kind of work both angles, but don't tell them that.
Well, I mean, you said it on... I mean, Empire doesn't
They gave it to
this.
Me at Star Wars Celebration a few years ago, which the Star Wars Celebration's coming up again.
Ooh.
In about a week and a half.
It's up in the Anaheims,
Anaheims
this year.
Yeah, it's in Anaheim. Yeah, you should go there.
I wanted to do that lip syncing contest.
Strawberry Festival in Portland, Tennessee.
It's a strawberry... It's May 8th and 9th. And it is their whole... The theme is May the Berries Be With You.
Great.
Not much of a stretch. That Katie liked that, of all things, because it's so lazy. I love it.
It's great.
May the Berries Be With You. And the 501st are going to be running around. So it's just going to be... You're going to eat strawberries. You're going to hang out with stormtroopers. Darth Vader is going to be cramming strawberries into the ventilator.
And now you're only allowed to eat dark berries because it's the Empire?
Or you'll be taken away.
Yeah, okay. That's fine.
I like the idea that it's imperialism coming in with the strawberries, too. There is kind of a dark undertone to it when the 501st comes in.
Anything else on the community court?
I'm going to go with this one. It's a podcast called We Talk Games.
Okay.
Where every week they go out and they find vintage arcade machines from back in the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Play them and then review the experience as adults compared to their experience as kids running around in arcades.
Please play Robotron 2084.
That might have been one of the episodes that I saw when I looked them up because this podcast looks awesome.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Loaded up on my iPod and ready to go.
Thank you, Kyle Clark.
No problem.
I'll be performing in Minneapolis this weekend. That'll be Friday, April 10th. And in Madison, Wisconsin, April 11th. I believe the Madison show sold out, and the first show in Minneapolis is sold out, but I believe there are still a handful of tickets available to the second show, the 10:30 show in Minneapolis. If you go to funcomfortabletour.com, one of my best friends, April Richardson, is opening for me on the road.
She's a national treasure.
I adore her, and she's hilarious, and she will be with me, and we'll do a show and find some good donuts somewhere. If you know of a good donut place in Minneapolis that's open late, let me know.
I imagine that has to exist.
This episode is Billy Crystal returns to the podcast.
That's a sentence that you never thought you'd get to say.
And he was fantastic. And then Josh Gad, who's also great. Josh sprung to fame in the Book of Mormon and then has worked a ton since then. And he's a super good dude. We're actually pitching a show together. And the show, the comedians, which, by the way, the showrunner is a guy that I've known since college, a guy named Ben Wexler.
Really?
Who's great. And I'm so happy that he has – because we watched – Jonah and I watched some of the episodes of The Comedians before they came on, and it's fan-fucking-tastic.
I don't know. That FX, they're not really good at putting out comedy shows.
They're the best thing in the industry
for like a decade now.
So the show, Comedians, premieres – tomorrow, when, from the time this goes up, April 9th at 10 p.m. on FX, and you should absolutely watch it.
Do you remember when Billy Crystal said he thinks he's going to do stand-up again?
Yeah, I remember.
I got real excited.
I invited him to come do beta tests at some point.
I maybe during beta test last night was hoping Billy Crystal was going to show up.
No, I haven't heard from him yet. I haven't heard from him yet.
But he should do it. Billy Crystal, do it.
There's podcast number 660. Katie, roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Katie, are we recording?
Yes.
Oh, why am I yelling? Sorry.
Katie?
Katie! Katie, where are my candies?
Bros. I didn't know that.
Do you guys, I think we can squeeze you guys all in. Oh, no scout today.
Wait. Will somebody get a picture of me and Billy and the Nerdist crew?
Yes.
Pretending to be talking on a microphone. Something.
Actually, would you mind just pretending to be listening to me while I'm talking?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, who are you?
Seriously.
I'll tell you right after. Who is he?
That's Jonah.
Yeah.
Jonah. Hi, Jonah. Were you there when we did the show? And
I was not able to come up that weekend.
Oh, Matt was there.
Matt was there, but was really I was not fun. Able to come up.
That's pretty great.
That looked pretty interesting.
It's pretty, I think it's, well, yeah, because Billy Crystal's face is excised.
Do you want me to take one from over this side?
Yes. Yeah. Billy, look at the camera, not be in fear of it. So on this shot, what I want you to do is I want you to pretend like you want to be with us.
Okay, Marty.
1, 2, 3. Thank you.
Yeah, that was really fun. Pixar's pretty amazing.
It was a great weekend.
Oh, you went up to Pixar?
Yeah. When they did Monsters University, we went up there.
I just went for the first time. It's the most unbelievable place. I wanted to literally quit what I do and go work there
just
as an
live
animator.
There. Yeah.
My friend Rashida Jones is writing a new movie for this, Toy Story 4.
Yeah.
And she's up there all the time.
The benefit that you have for being a recognizable person is that you could just go walk around there, and I don't think anyone would stop you. You could just be like, oh, I'm working on that, and then just trail off whatever you're saying.
I should just
like,
do that. I should just go. I never wanted to leave. I never wanted to leave that place. It's magical.
I took a picture with the big lamp in the front. That
I know. I did that. It's like going to Disneyland. It's everything you want to take a picture of.
Yes.
I took a picture with one Mike Wazowski.
What?
I know. My friend who's at the entrance. You're at both entrances because they have the Monsters, Inc. characters in one.
Right.
And then they have the Monsters University characters in the other.
Do they?
It's just you get younger in every building.
Much like my bio. I'm 46 in my bio.
Billy Crystal is the one who sued IMDb for revealing ages. He's like, you guys got to
do
it.
I did not do that.
I'm much younger.
I did not do that.
Well, Josh said it, so I think it must be true.
It must be true.
Like, not, well, okay then.
And because he said that, Wikipedia can now source
yes,
it.
Yes, that's
so
right.
Now it's a thing.
This is the thing. Billy Crystal's officially 46 years old and has sued IMDb.
No, I did. Please, anyone out there?
Spreading
lies. Well, I'm looking at it right now on the internet.
Help
these
me.
These motherfuckers. How dare they? I mean, it's
that's
all right
me
here.
Too. That's not me, too. That's,
says definitely Billy Crystal.
Not
I mean,
me.
It says,
not me.
It says right there.
Definitely Twitter Billy Crystal. Must be
not,
Billy Crystal.
No, I don't think so. Don't think so.
I'm very excited for your show because I just got it and I watched the first episode of it last night. And I didn't know what it when I got the thing. I'm like, oh, I didn't know they were doing a. And it's a dream. Besides you guys too, it's a dream team.
Yes,
yeah. I've known Ben Wexler since college.
Oh, he's the best.
And Larry Charles and like it's
Borat, Bruno, Curb, Seinfeld. The guy is just unreal.
How long do you think when you guys are doing press junkets before someone's like, so did you audition for this part? Like not realizing. Like, no,
It would be a confusing question. one of which we would answer, no, we did not. No. Billy actually was involved before I was. You want to tell the?
Yeah, well, I was sent this show from Sweden, which. With all due respect to Sweden, I don't think of it as the funny place.
That's Norway.
It's dark at noon, and then they drink.
Yeah.
And these two actors, the show was called The Comedians, and these two brilliant guys, it's our premise, a veteran comic team with a younger guy, reluctantly to do a late-night sketch show for the network. And They don't like each other. They don't think either one is funny, but in their heart, they know that they really need each other at the same time. So I watched the first one, and 5 minutes into it, I'm thinking, I want to do this. Because for me, it was a chance to play a version of myself, and also whoever at that point was going to be team with me was going to be somebody great, hopefully, and we would be able to do sketches and live sketches in front of a live audience, which we had envisioned right away.
And at that point, you didn't realize you were going to have to settle. For me, there was still hope.
That's
it
true.
Was still like you were still dreaming of possibilities.
Right. And but Andy Dick is such a different way to go.
Yeah.
Such a different way to go.
You know, he just didn't want to do it.
No.
And
no.
So
no.
Josh,
no.
You know,
his quote was way too high for what they were what they were willing
and,
to do.
And then we set out to you know, put the team together to first of all to produce it. And so that we reached out, people kept coming in, and then Larry came in, and I knew I wanted him right away from our first meeting. And then Ben and Matt Nix came in as a team, and I didn't really know them, but when we talked and spent some time together, we all said, let's do this together. And then we set out to, you know, put the creative team together, and that's when I met Josh at a...
Benefit for Billy Crystal.
It wasn't a benefit for me. It was
money for your IMDb campaign.
Yes, right.
The legal was not a
benefit. We got to go pay the legal fees.
You know, these kids today. I was being honored at the Geffen Theater. It was a benefit for the Geffen Theater.
It was. Billy was being an honoree, and they asked me to come in and sing to him, which was kind of a dream come true. I grew up with about five legends that I sort of wanted to be like, and also Billy Crystal. And so for me, no, but Billy was literally one of those people. I remember seeing Princess Bride at a young age, and it just left this indelible impression on me. And I always tell Billy the story about when I watched Comic Relief 5 with he, Robin, and Whoopi. I literally wanted to jump into the screen and be a part of that trio. I looked at him and I go, this is what I want to do with my life. His charisma, the way that he owned the stage, all of it, I was just mesmerized by. And then his Oscar hosting and everything else.
That's so enough.
When you get...
Who are you other for? What if it was like, well, it's Billy and Frank Stallone, Mussolini.
Frank Stallone.
Just like
Roger Clinton.
A real murderer's
so
row.
Weird is,
you know, Billy Carter was great.
Rabbit Marinville.
Weird relative.
And Yogi Berra.
And Yogi Berra, of course.
He's not even real.
And so I, to get an opportunity to work with a legend like that, who you admire the hell out of.
So we met. I'm going to stop you because it's just too much.
No.
It
disappointed me in every
spoke. He was sensationally sang a number from what was the show you did?
A Little Show Called Book of Mormon.
And so he sang Man Up, and he was great, and we're backstage, and Carl Reiner was there, and Clint Eastwood was there.
Oh, that's right.
And
Morgan Freeman
was there, and that was pretty great because Morgan was narrating my day. That was part of the honoree. He actually did the voiceover of my day. Billy got up and took a shower just like he does every day. Reaches for the so then we spoke, and he was coming in the next day to meet with Larry, Ben, and Matt and I. And usually those meetings are a half hour, 40 minutes. We were there 3 hours. And by the time we were past the spraying of the musk and the running together and butting of the heads, we were just improvising stuff. And then he left, and we didn't want him to go. And we all looked at each other and said, well, you know, cancel a call of Jack Black. This guy. No, it just felt right. And he's so multi-talented. And what surprised me was, because I had only seen Book of Mormon, which was, first of all, sensational. When you see somebody for the first time and you go, who's this guy? You know, and I'd seen him on a Daily Show and so on. But that's not his thing. When he's in front of an audience, he comes alive, and his timing was unusual and great, and his power on stage and the way he handled himself, that I just thought we were, you know, this was going to be the perfect match, and it's proven to be.
So what was the decision to essentially play characterized versions of yourselves?
We all met and said, all right, so am I Bobby Goldman? Who am I?
Right.
You know, and we all said, maybe we should just play ourselves. And Matt and Ben went, well, you would do that?
You would do that?
Because that'll really
help. And by
the
way, it is a scare. I'm terrified 3 weeks before we premiere. there's something so gratifying and terrifying at the same time, because you are playing versions of yourselves, but you're playing heightened, very meta versions that aren't quite you. But if audiences don't know you well enough, they could assume that that is you.
Yeah.
And we make some bold choices on the show, and we do some things that I don't think Billy and I on a daily basis might do. And that's the joy of it. But it's also scary as hell, because you're assuming that everybody's in on the joke, and that's what you're hoping
right,
for.
Yeah.
But that was the fun of it. That's why we immediately were like, if we're going to do this, the only way to really do it, and it's the way the Swedish show does it, is they are playing themselves. They're big comics in Sweden. And we were like, if we're going to do it, let's go all the way with it. And the show goes beyond just the meta of casting the two of us playing ourselves. You also have Larry Charles, who's directing the pilot, in the pilot, playing a director who's fired from the pilot.
I loved him. I was so sad to see him.
I know. And there's this rabbit hole of meta on the show that I think, you know, there's a precedent for it in Curb Your Enthusiasm and shows like Larry Sanders and Louie. But this, I feel, takes it even one step further. And it's descent.
Is it more freeing in a way? Like, can you go farther out because you're playing yourself and it's ridiculous? Or do you have to keep a little more grounded?
You have to keep a little more. It's a very fine line, I have to say that. Because there's some things I would go up to them after seeing a page and go, I can't do that. I'll do this, but I won't do that. That's right. A little too much. But usually I cross my own personal line several times.
You really do. But we both sort of like, at first, we'd get these pages, and you're so vulnerable because you're like, well, somebody's writing this thing about me, so do they think this is who I am? And is this their perception of me? And so we'll talk it out. And there were some difficult episodes where Billy and I have to go after each other and do it in a way that's, you know, that is a hyper meta version of who we are. And so we would always come up to each other after we would do one of those scenes and be like, we okay? We know that even though we don't have different character names, and even though we're calling ourselves Billy and Josh, I want you to know that that's not what I think about you. And Billy would say vice versa, and we'd be on with it. And that was challenging at times, but I feel like we not only went there, but we completely pot committed to it, and didn't look back. Yeah,
I think it's fun for the layer that I think comedy nerds will really enjoy is watching the generational, like watching a guy who's been around for a while who appreciates joke structure and versus like a young punk comic who's just like, and then I'll suck your cock. Yeah. You're like, why do you have to, you know, like just watching I understand.
Because that's every conversation comedians have is like, I don't know if they're doing it right. Yeah. These kids, I don't know. Just absurdity on absurdity?
That's the essence of the show. I always joke around that the show doesn't need to be called The Comedians. It could be called The Butchers. It could be called, you know, The Tailors, The Car Salesman. It's about the disconnect that exists in, I think, every vocation between younger and older generations and their approaches, especially right now when over the past 50 plus years, you've seen a huge, huge gap in terms of technology and everything else. And how people approach things is completely different now than people would have approached things back then. Comedy's no different. Billy comes from an era that, ironically, I actually relate to more than my character on the show, because I grew up almost with the same exact storyline as Billy. The first time he ever knew that he wanted to be a comedian, it was in the Catskill Mountains. That was my very first encounter with comedy, where I looked at the stage, I looked at this Borscht Belt comedian, and I said, I want to do that. Like an eerie sort of similarity. But generationally, you do see that disconnect, and you do see younger alt comics who are sort of trying to come from a place of irony and come from a completely different place than the joke structure that the previous generation came from. And I love that. I love the battle of those two types of approaches to the same goal.
I like seeing characters where one is like, I was influenced by you, and the other guy's like, no, you weren't. Like the guy being like, how? I don't see it. You know, like, see, because there are, you know, when I look at all the comics
who influenced me the most, and certainly it'd be you and Steve Martin and right. Seinfeld and Kinison and Stephen Wright and Emo Phillips and Pryor and Bill Hicks and like
Bill Hicks
and all these people. And I don't see any of my I see nothing about any of that group in what I write now,
right?
Which is sort of strange. So do you think you just take molecules here and there and somehow it kind of snowballs and forms?
Yeah, see, I don't think it's strange. I think you absorb, you know, all kinds of things, and then you use what you – when you find yourself as you get, you know, more mature and grow and your taste develops on your own, then you find your own way. And I think that's what I think is happening.
Does it really make you uncomfortable when people are like, you really influenced my career? And it's like, is it sort of, do you go, okay, yeah, it's weird, I don't know.
No, I love it.
Okay, good.
No, yeah, it's very sweet.
Who
but
influenced
it,
you?
Well, everyone I saw influenced me. You know, the ones that I loved were, you know, when I grew up in the 50s, my youth was in the 50s. My comedy taste developed starting in the 60s with Stan Freberg, Mel and Carl, 2000-Year-Old Man, Lenny Bruce, Bill Cosby, before he became a bartender. Robert Klein, the amazing George Carlin, who was funny for 50, 60 years.
Carson.
Yeah, and then everybody, from Bob Hope to Johnny.
Tom Lehrer, were you a Tom Lehrer fan?
Yeah, I love Tom Lehrer. The musical parodies would later play into things that I did on the Oscars.
Yeah.
You know, and all of those really funny people. Plus, every Sunday night was the Ed Sullivan Show. And, you know, we had three channels, 2, 4, and 7 on your local station. So we had, what, 6 channels, 7 mm-hmm. channels to play with? But Sunday nights was comedy time. So then you'd get the more traditional guys like Alan King, you know, who was always sensational on the shows. But for me, I would watch Steve Allen because Steve was what Letterman later would become, what Jimmy really is doing now. Steve did all those things before anybody else. And he had a great group with him. Don Knotts, Tom Poston, Louis Nye, The Man on the Street stuff. Yeah. All of these things, I encourage anyone who wants funny, find the albums, listen to them. Nichols and May, Live on Broadway, yes. One of the greatest comedy albums of all time. So it's, for me, my dad had a record store, and he would bring home these comedy albums. So those albums became my rock and roll. I don't know much about rock and roll music, but I know the album, the comedy albums. That's what I listen to.
It's amazing that now, and maybe this is just sort of like old man get off my lawn talk, but I remember listening to albums over and comedy albums over yeah. and over
did,
and
we?
Over
we
and
did.
Over. I yeah. mean, like I know.
But even by the way, like that was even happening in the 90s. Like I grew up listening to Sandler stuff over and over and over again. Yeah.
And Sandler
that,
and Young.
Adam
one was Belgian
Adam
and one
Sandler.
Was.
And like, I'm in the Sandlers.
Like Tollbooth Willie and all that stuff was sort of like so influential. Yeah. I grew up listening to the LP of the original season of Saturday Night Live. My parents had like an LP of it. Even the Second City. Like Second City has these incredible records.
Fireside Theater. Just the Fireside
was the greatest.
Yeah.
And
What Is Reality? Pep Rally.
And of course, what was a Canadian show that Moranis came from?
SCTV.
SCTV. Yeah. Like all that stuff. I listened to those albums religiously. Steve Martin, like all that stuff. But I don't feel like we do that anymore. I don't feel like.
Because people are just like, rah, rah, rah,
Mark.
Yeah. Right. Like they just eat, they consume something immediately. Like,
and I guess it's also because of YouTube. You can watch comedians now. It's all instantly accessible.
Well, it's also, I think, just the ubiquity of content. I mean, there, you know, it's like what you were saying. There was just less content. So when you got something, you really drilled down on it. But now it's like there's so much of
almost
everything.
Too much. We used to when Steve when after Steve. He was so influential on me, just watching him. He became like this, and I got to know him very well. His wife played my mother in City Slickers, Jane Meadows. It's her voiceover. And I did Steve's show as frequently as I could out here. Then came Ernie Kovacs.
Yeah.
Kovacs, if you watched his show, had no studio audience, but it was hilarious because he'd have a small group of stagehands. And they'd laugh, and he encouraged them to laugh. So maybe you heard 5 or 6 guys, and you felt like you were in on the joke. and you're in on something really special and really amazing. And his visual content, he died in 62. So his
Wow.
Yeah, so his visual content way back then was unbelievable.
He's doing a lot of weird, surreal stuff.
So he has a comedy half hour that's silent. he's in a museum, and he plays this schleppy character who walks through a museum, and it's all silent. It's amazing. And he was sponsored by Dutch Master Cigars, and he smoked big cigars. So he did one underwater. And he's totally underwater with, and he's smoking a cigar, and he blew milk out of his mouth, so it looked like it was smoke. But it was, he did it live. It was, he was like, and a Nairobi Trio, and Percy Duff tonsils, and all of these characters he created. You know, getting back to who influenced me, those guys were like giants.
So when people say like, oh, you were such a big influence, you go, oh, yeah, yeah, but these guys over here, they were the guys.
Well, they make you want to do it. You know, they make you want to do it. I mean, who's funnier than Phil Silvers and Bilko? That character is astoundingly funny. I mean, he was aggressive and funny, and he was, oh, Colonel Hull! I mean, they were these were like what we would call starker guys. They were big, strong vaudeville performers who were now being plugged into the new medium of television.
Yeah.
And Sid, of course.
I don't even think I realized until Mel Brooks was on the show a couple of years ago. I didn't realize Sid was alive until kind of recently.
Right. Passed away recently.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
But I think he was a guy that I just like, oh, he. I think he might have.
By the way, I went into a New York deli when I was doing Book of Mormon, and I saw one of the coolest things. I wish I had taken a picture, but it was Mel, Sid, and I believe Carl, all sitting at Edison, the Edison Hotel restaurant.
Right.
And I literally shit my pants. I was like, are you kidding me? These three giants of comedy. Yeah.
Hanging out like people.
Yeah.
Did you talk to him?
I didn't. I was too nervous. I was. Too,
I would be too.
Yeah, I was too intimidated.
Because there's no way to...
How do you even approach that group?
No. The fan part of your brain squashes down any coherent thought or sentence that might come out, and it's just there's.
I don't know.
You guys,
are also do what I like.
I like you.
I was very fortunate to have. First of all, Mel and Carl are very, very good friends, and Mel makes an appearance on the show.
That's a great scene. It's
really funny.
Yeah, I love that scene so much.
And I became very friendly with Mr. Caesar, and when he died, I wrote a piece in the New York Times about him and what he meant to me. He was the Charlie Chaplin of television. This is 1953. First TV stuff was, started in the late 40s, so 5 years into it, think of the movie business in only 5 years. So you're dealing with Chaplin and Keaton. He was unbelievable, but surrounded himself also, like we have a terrific cast in our show, with the best people, Howard Morris, Imogene Coca, Carl Reiner, and an amazing writing staff. And, it's Larry Gelbart, and it's Neil Simon, and later Woody, and, so it was, and he knew that, and he was in failing health, and I go up to the house. I got a call that he wanted to see me. I did 460 or something performances of my one-man show on Broadway. So there was only one time that I could say I was nervous, and one time I could say I was really nervous. It wasn't opening night. It wasn't closing night. I was nervous when I knew Mel was in the audience, and I was really nervous when Sid came. Sid came to my last show here. We moved it from an evening show to a matinee so he could make it because he was not in good health. And he was in a wheelchair then. And I kept thinking of him the whole time because things that I was doing were all things that I remember him doing. And that, you imitate when you're little. That's all you imitate till you start to find your way. And mime stuff and character stuff he was doing in 1953 and 1954, and I'm 5 years old, and my dad would let me stay up late and really like point at the black and white set and so look at this guy, and I went up to the house, and he was very frail, and on his bed were screeners from the Academy for the pictures he was going to vote for the Academy Awards, and there was the French film, the actor, the silent movie,
The Artist,
and it's on his bed, and I said, "Jesus, Sid, look at that! Did you like it? Yeah, I did." But I said, reminded me of, and I may name a sketch that he did on Show of Shows, about a silent film actor who's a big star, and then talkies come in, and he's got a very high-pitched voice. And now we can't get work. But there's a headline that says, talkies are in, and there's a close-up of him, and he goes, I'll talk. And we started running lines from the sketch together, and he's in a hospital bed.
Wow.
And there's a scene where he calls Flo Ziegfeld to get work on Broadway. And I remember at 6 years old, I had an Aunt Florence, who we call Flo. And I would call, I would see her, and I would go, hello, Flo. And she would laugh hysterically. And so I'm doing, hello, Flo, with the great Sid Caesar in his bed. And it was like, it was unbelievable to me. You know, these guys, you know, are, you know, for comedians of my generation, They're Tom Jefferson, they're Adams, they're the founding fathers, you know, that's who they are for me. Mm-hmm. And I look at them and look at their work still, and you can now, which is fantastic. Their work is unbelievable, and it was live on television.
It is funny that we get kind of arrogant, as young comics, you get kind of arrogant, and you go, oh, I mean, shit wasn't funny like it is now. And then you watch old stuff, and you're like, "Oh yeah, actually it was." And but it was very structured,
right?
And but you still see a lot of like, "Oh, I see the punk rock jokes in there." They're still subverting important things and authority.
Well,
or
if you go back sure. to even the early years of Saturday Night Live, some of the stuff that they were doing would be considered dangerous today.
Oh, there's no question.
I mean, it's like yes. We have grown, but it all starts from that like crazy 60s, 70s movement where it's like all these guys, including Billy, who was involved in the earliest days of SNL and all that, and watching the 40th reminded me of how subversive some of that stuff was.
Well, that sketch with Chevy Chase and Richard Pryor
is one of them. You could not get away with that
never,
on TV today.
Never. So you, I didn't. I was working the night that the 40th aired, but I did see them. You were in the monologue.
Yes.
Did you do anything else on the show?
No. There was just and it was very frustrating because I love that studio. It's Yankee Stadium to me. It's like it's a great place to work, and everybody was there, and I was dying to get up and do something. But I had what two lines in the opening or whatever it was with Steve and Alec Baldwin and everyone else who was up there, and just being around it again was so great. And I had an amazing moment. I think I sent you a picture from the studio. It was Sunday afternoon. It was rehearsal. And as usual, nobody knew what they were going to be doing 4 hours from now. And Paul Simon came in from Australia and just arrived and rehearsed, still crazy after all these years, on stage alone. There was maybe five or six of us in the studio. And that sound, the wailing sax solo in that, the organ, his voice, really to me was the sound of SNL mm-hmm. in the beginning. He was so, you know, I think he hosted the second show. But that sound and the words, 40 years later, still crazy after all these years, was so perfect. You know, and that was amazing to see everybody there, and that was a really fun red carpet, man. Hmm.
Were you hanging out a bunch, or were you watching the show?
I was there. I went in the audience. I finished my little bit, and I ran right up into the audience.
Even crazier than who was on stage was who was in the stands. People who never even got up.
Yeah.
There were some amazing people, when they would pan across the audience, you'd see all of these like A-listers who had nothing to do with the show.
Well, it was so weird. I'm sitting with Chappelle, and across from the aisle is Sarah Palin. I'm going, what's going on here? But it was a very special night. I'm, you know, really proud to be part of in any way in the lineage of that show.
Do you ever miss traditional stand-up?
Yeah, I'm thinking about getting back out there. I was driving around last night after babysitting my grandchildren. I thought, you know, I passed the improv and I went, yeah, I got a couple of ideas. Maybe one time I'll go up there, maybe do a little tour. Maybe.
Oh, that'd be fun.
I'm itchy. I'm a little itchy. The show was fantastic to do, you know, my Broadway show, but it had elements of stand-up in it. But to go out and talk about where I am now and what I'm doing might be a really fun thing to do.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, I'm guessing, I've never done a Broadway show, but it seems like you sort of hone it down and then it's it's kind of its own thing. You can't. With stand-up, you can fuck around and take left and right turns and talk to the audience, but I imagine when you're doing a show, it's like, well, this is kind of how this show works.
Yeah, but it was, you know, there were moments I could drift, as long as I knew how to come back to a light cue or a music cue, you know, because it's all, you know, they're waiting for me to say something that's going to, someone's going to press a switch that's going to make the lights change, and, you know, because we had a story to tell. But there were many nights I would drift off and find new things and always come back to the... to the melody, basically, you know. That's the jazz of it when it's good.
If you're working out around town, would you come in as an unannounced guest and just, like, drop in on a show?
Yeah, I would probably do that, but I hate to take time away from, you know, young comedians.
I think people would be okay with it.
No, I you know.
That's very considerate, though.
No, but it used to happen to me all the time when I first started, and some big names would come in. They're going to do their Tonight Show, you know, and... and instead of doing the 6 minutes, they do an hour and a half. And
that's that's what you don't do. You just don't have to do an hour and a half. Yeah. But if you did 15 minutes, like, everyone would be thrilled. I think it'd be fun.
It would be very exciting for that audience. What?
So I've been a little itchy.
I think you should do it.
Did you when you're not hosting the Oscars, do you miss hosting the Oscars?
No, I don't.
Really?
No,
it seems like a thankless job. Like, it seems
it can be.
Yeah.
It can be.
Was it maybe not so much before and now in the age of social media? It's got now since everybody's become a critic, you're instantaneously.
You got a big target on you. You know, and the show is what the show is, and it's hard to make it different. And then when you try, either it works or it just doesn't. And when it doesn't, you're crucified for it. So, you know.
Well, the audience there does not seem like fun, to be honest.
It's hard. It's hard because they're all in uncomfortable clothes. The first five rows, they're nominated. And within the first hour, four out of five of them have lost. So they're not happy.
Right.
And then, you know, there are so many awards. It's hard to do the bulk of the ones that people are not that interested in. There's a long stretch of, you know, sound effects editing, documentary. You know, people, for the people who made them, this is what they're waiting for. But for the people at home, it's like, and so, you know, it's when it was good, it was great. And I had a great time doing it most of the time. And I love the people I did it with. And we had some big moments on the show. And but it's very hard now. Back then, it was like three critics that you wanted to, if you pay attention to them. It was Janet Maslin in the Times, Tom Shales, at that point was in the Washington Post, and I thought the best of them all was Howard Rosenberg here with the LA Times. He was a great, really good critic, I thought. And now it's this thousands and thousands of them during the show. And, you know, you don't want it in your mind coming off going, am I trending?
That's exactly what happens. You make a joke, and if that joke doesn't work, everybody in the world is talking about it out.
Well, that's
once.
Sort of like when they had Seth MacFarlane do it, and then, you know, he made a couple of jokes that were, you know, like Seth MacFarlane, and then people were like, how could he? Like, well, what did you think was going to happen?
I thought the boob song was exactly what
did you not look at a second of his work before this, and you seem, you know, I mean, it's like, but everyone just... I mean, I get that it is the pinnacle of what you would do if you're an actor, you'd be the Oscars, but I feel like everyone's just so serious and so like, this is the most important thing. It's like, it's not, I mean, it's important, but it's not the most important thing.
It also now is there, yes, that's true, but also now comes at the end of when it first started, of course, there were just the Emmys and the Oscars and the Grammys, and then...
There's award fatigue, for sure.
My God, and then Dick Clark created the American Music Awards. And then became the People's Choice Awards, and then became the Award Awards, and the Outstanding Pet Shows, and whatever. It's just, it became too many. There's just too many. So you've already seen everybody, you know, and you sort of know who's going to win. You know, there are very few horse races anymore.
Right. And it's the last opportunity to do the jokes.
Yeah.
It's like all the jokes have been made, the Golden Globes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like you kind of have to.
And when I did it you know, when I was doing it frequently, it used to be on Mondays. It used to be on Monday night. I used to love that because people would have to, it became more like there was an urgency. It wasn't like the Sunday's Oscar day, like the Super Bowl. They had to leave work. They had to get, there was more of an urgency to watch the show. And when we would, you know, at our height with, you know, the funny openings and stuff, I used to love to watch newsmen On the local news saying, well, I'm getting out of here. I want to see how that show's going to open. You know, it used to be fun. You know, so I like it when it was on Monday nights. It felt more...
I forgot that it used to be on Monday.
Now it's the all-day thing that they can build around it.
It's the coverage of everybody arriving on the red carpet. Yeah.
It's such bad coverage. I was watching it before I went to work that day, and it was just all puns of... You know, they were talking about Rosamund Pike's dress, and it's like, and she was pregnant, but she wore this dress. I think this dress is Gone Girl. And it's just like, I wanted to punch through. I wish there was a haptic feedback on my TV screen so I could do this and then watch it go out. Like, I just wanted some.
Well, the worst part is them, like a guy will be up, an actor, and they'll be like, oh, tell us about, you know, the process of doing it. And then an actress walks up and they go, tell us about your dress.
Oh, yeah.
It's like they don't have any care about what they're doing.
But, I got to present at the Emmys for the first time this year, and that scared the shit out of me. But I saw you after the show, and it was a flurry of activity. And I want to re-express that I think what you said and did was wonderful, and also, I know it couldn't have been an easy thing. So
it was the hardest thing I've had to do because it was so public. You know, it was only 2 weeks after Robin had passed away, and it was so. You know, there's so much to listen. It's months now, and I'm still processing. And you know, I don't know if I'll ever get through everything. But that was hard, and to try to find the right words and humor and laughs and not break down in front of everybody. At the rehearsal the day before, I walked out, saw his picture up there, and I walked off. I said, "I can't do this. I'm not ready yet." And I came back a half hour later and just read it. But you know, it was so confusing. It was so painful, will always be that. And so, you know, just to, I remember seeing you and another moment when I walked off, Jay was there, Leno was there, who had come to see me before the show started. And, you know, Jay and I started out together. Robin came a little bit after us, and we've all been very close. And Jay was just so emotionally just held on to me and just, you know, wouldn't let me go for a while. And that was a nice feeling. It's what I needed at the time. And that an old friend like him was there, that was, you know, it was something. It's still odd and confusing and maddening. And we all, you know, think of him. I think of him all the time.
I was in the backstage area where they corral people, and I was watching it next to Jay and just watching him. He was just shaking his head, and I could see his eyes welling up, and it just like it was. He was profoundly watching you, watching the thing. But I think it was important because I don't think there's anybody else that could have done it besides you. I don't think anyone else would have. I don't think it would have helped as much. But I think it really, as hard as it may have been, I have to say, I think it really helped.
I don't think I've ever heard something so brilliantly boiled down as what a concept. It just, that is the thing I'll always remember, is because it perfectly epitomizes who that man was and how unique he was. And in my lifetime, I don't remember that many passings that had that much of a devastating response, where everybody around the world just sort of stopped and was like, How can this be? Because he was such a life force.
Well, yeah, obviously we understand how humanity works. We understand what happens. We understand that we lose people. And I just lost my dad the year before. I understand.
So sorry.
But it's still the idea that, like, there are some people, a very few people in the world, where you're like, oh, that can't be. That's not – he's right. Immortal. How is that even remotely possible?
Yeah, we were in Rome when I got the call, and – so we turned around and came right back. And then the Rome airport was an international newsstand. And headlines all around the world. His face. Everywhere. Russian newspapers. London. Spain. You name it. And it that was the story of the day. This hateful world that's getting stranger and more violent every day stopped for a second to go, oh, no. And that, I thought, was pretty astounding.
Yeah. I mean, to be able to take something like this and still be able to, I mean, this is part of what comedy helps us process. This is what comedy helps us do. And that's why, you know, like seeing that you could take something, be respectful, but also know that it was important to try to, you know, relieve some of the tension with comedy. I mean, I often wonder how people who don't have comedy in their lives deal with horrible things.
Right? Yeah. Well, I was off to the left on stage and the In Memoriam package, which was difficult enough.
Yeah.
Because there was some very incredible people a part of that year. And I walked out, and everyone knew I was going to do it, but yet there was 6,000. That's a big place. So there's about 5,000 or 6,000 people in that theater. And they, as Wonder had just turned to me, and it was, okay, here we go. And it was thick with sadness and confusion. And, you know, there was just a look in people's eyes. I remember, you know, just looking at people, just they were looking at me going, help.
Yeah.
What are you going to...
And so, you're just as confused as everyone else.
Yeah, and, you know, he was my closest friend, and it was just so... I don't know, even how to talk about it anymore.
Well, and I think watching... I don't know if this makes any sense, but watching the first episode of your show last night and watching you be okay and be funny and make it, like, it kind of made me feel better about everything. It kind of made me feel like, okay, yeah, Billy's doing better, so I feel okay. Like, I feel okay, Billy's okay, I feel okay.
You know, I sent him the shows when I think they sent 10 or 12 of the Swedish shows. And I was telling him about it, that I'm thinking I'm going to do this. And he goes, let me see him. So I sent him, and he went crazy how great they were and got it right away, what we would do with it. And he, you know, he was so happy that it was going to be the right thing for me, that, you know, I think about him all the time whenever I get a chance to play with Josh and do stories that are so inspiring and funny and offbeat, and I'm happy doing them.
Yeah.
He wasn't happy doing his show when the crazy ones. He wasn't feeling well, and he didn't even know what was going on with him. It was before he was diagnosed with a Parkinson's, and he wasn't well. He knew something was going on, but he just wasn't really... He knew that I would be happier in my show than he was in his. Mm-hmm. And that made him joyous for me. And that's why, you know, friends like that and people like that are so rare to you know, pull from me that way and know that it would be, a good situation. And it's, some of the shows I do, I wish I could pick up the phone and call them and say, you know what we did today? You know, so, you know.
Well, I think it's, and everyone who's lost people knows this, I think, but... The thing that I've been feeling is, you know, even though I know that, like, certain people aren't around, my dad is not around, I still kind of feel, I think back and the things that used to make me sad are very comforting to me. Or I feel like, oh, yeah. Or I feel like, I really feel like it's still there in my molecules. Like,
yeah.
I feel like it's still a part of the thing. And even just sort of having conversations still, you know,
yeah.
is very
My
helpful.
Only regret with him, listen, I had him in my life for a long time, and I'm forever grateful for that. And we had some amazing moments on and off stage. My only regret is that we didn't tape record our phone calls and make an album of them. Or go in, you know, with one of my last calls with him, I said, why don't you come down, or I'll come up there, and we'll just rent the studio for 2-3 days, and we'll just go and see what we have. Because they were so bizarre and great. We would go for hours sometimes and hang up like sweating. like that was a workout, you know, because it was just... I'm watching Ronald Reagan's funeral. I'll share and I told this at his memorial. I'm watching the Reagan's funeral. Phone rings. I look at the phone. I see it's 41, you know, he was in San Francisco. So I said, oh, all right. I go, hello, and I hear this. Bill? Hi, it's Ron. Mr. Reagan? Yeah, well, you can call me Ronnie. Everybody at the studio called me Ronnie, and I think of you as a studio guy. But how is this possible? I'm watching your funeral. Oh, that's my stunt guy. So, how is heaven? "Well, you know, I'm a little confused. It's a lot hotter than I thought it was." I said, "Well, you may not be in heaven, because if it's hot, you may be in the other place." "Oh, well, that would explain why I'm in a hot tub and Nixon's balls are resting on the bridge of my nose." Yeah, yeah. That was, so we had, you know, blessed moments like that.
Well, I think it's it is important that because I think there are a lot of comics, you know, I'm assuming Robin being a prime example of people not being able to connect with how much joy they bring the world. So I think it's important when you do have a job that you like, or you are doing stuff that you really do should really try to enjoy it. I mean, like that's important.
I've had the best time. We every day we just go, we got a chance to do this. You know, the shows are very strong. They're very funny. They're very smart. They're very inventive. As the season progresses, it'll take people to a different place. As you know, we carefully scripted this whole season with an arc for us getting on the air and getting a time slot that we wanted, and so on and so forth. The show was all about the process of making the show,
mm-hmm.
and during the course of it, you know, on Itzers, you know, at home, we'll see that Josh and I have a show within the show called the Billy and Josh Show. So that's mostly in front of a live audience or these film pieces that roll in and out.
Are you doing those real really sketches good. In front of the audience?
Yeah, yeah.
The one with the businessman talking at the same time.
Yeah.
It's like when the first time you show, I love that it becomes a runner.
Yeah.
But like I love it by the end. It just keeps on escalating. I was just like, this is perfect. It's the perfect way to do, like, it's like a hybrid show.
I'll tell you what was so special about that one is Mel Brooks was at the table read for that one before he did the guest star. And he and Mel is still to this day, as well as he should be, he's earned it, the most critical person when it comes to comedy. And so you feel like you're doing this in front of like your favorite teacher, and you want to make sure that you're going to get an A+. And he hears that sketch and he goes, "Now that is funny. That is very funny." And it was like to hear that from that man meant everything, because it's like, all right, well, we got one that worked.
Yeah. I told a story on the podcast before. I think it was when Mel was on. Is a friend of mine named Rob Paulson, who's a voiceover guy, was working on the animated version of Spaceballs like years and years ago, and he was super freaked out, but he was this young cocky comedy guy, and Mel Brooks was there, and Mel was like, there are these characters called dinks, and we need a name for one. This one dink brings someone a thing of water, and we need to come up with a name for it. And Rob goes, "I got it. Gunga Dink," thinking he was going to get carried out of the room in celebration. And Mel pointed at him and goes, "Kid, wit is shit. Funny is money. Any more ideas?" And Rob just sank down, just chubbed up in his chair. And I told that story to Mel, and he was like, "That sounds like something I would have said."
When you sit with him, we would have these regular Monday lunches, and you know, that I got invited to by Phil Rosenthal. And Phil put these lunches together, and I'm sitting there, and it's Norman Lear, and it's Carl, and it was the late Larry Gelbart, who was a genius guy and an amazing comedy writer, but a wonderful person, and Mel, and it was just every Monday, you know, you go to the Hall of Fame. And I've known him since 1977.
Wow.
Our kids, his son Max, who created the whole
Max,
zombie.
Max, genius.
Yeah.
Genius.
And my daughter Jenny were in elementary school together. They were in school together. They were roommates. They were classmates. And so now I'm like, oh my God, I go to my first parent-teacher meeting and Mel's there. And with Ann Banker, who's like, it was just so crazy. So when I finished my first run on Broadway, and the producers was right across the street from our theater, We finished. We went to Tony. It was a great year. All right. I'm on my way back to L.A. Mel calls. "Billy, Mel, listen. Do the producers. You'll do it till, you know, Christmas. And you'll make whatever deal you want to make. And that'll be great. And then, you know, it'll be perfect. You're Max. You'll be a Max." I said, "Oh, Mel, With all due respect, I love the show. I've waited for you to ask me to do something my entire life. But I don't want to be the eighth guy to play Max Bialystock. He goes, you won't be. You'll be the 12th.
That's brilliant. And then he tried to recruit Billy and I to do it again.
Yeah, when he did the show.
Yeah. I want you guys to think about doing it. You play Bialystock and Bloom. The thing is, I want you to go on tour with it. As if that would be like the most appealing version of coming back to doing it.
But do you understand the weight of what you're saying? Is that like if someone took young Josh Gad aside and go,
it's incredible.
Someday Mel Brooks is going to ask you to be in the producers and you're going to tell him no.
I left with the shittiest grin on my face the first time we met Mel. We went into his office. You see all of these posters that have left this unbelievable influence on you growing up, from Blazing Saddles to
The Elephant Man.
Young
Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein, the producers, all of these unbelievable things. By the way, he's got all of his awards on a mantle, and his favorite one is the Satellite Award.
It's a science fiction award.
It's a science fiction award. That's the one he's proudest of. And
it's not even his. It's Max's.
It's Max's. That's the craziest part.
Max is now into, no one says zombies funnier than Mel Brooks. He's into zombies.
Incredible.
They're the walking dead like my Uncle Bernie.
and he's showing you all this stuff. And the thing that he's proudest of beyond anything else is that he has water at his disposal at any time.
I know. See, the little paper cups of
and
water.
That's real. He loves offering water.
He pours it. It's not bottles. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an old-fashioned pitcher. It's amazing.
But it's funny what sticks with you, because when he was growing up and when he was a young person broke and, you know, struggling, to him that was probably like, that's how you've made it, when you have water at your disposal and you can freely pour it to people and it's clean. Like
that last special he did was amazing, too. The last HBO special was fantastic.
Oh, he, by the way, is still as sharp as
89.
He's unreal.
And so is Carl. Carl's 93.
Yeah.
I think it's...
Gives you hope.
It does give you hope. And I think, you know, because a lot of us have seen it go the other way, where it's like, guys you idolize and then they disappear for a while and they come back and you're like, I don't know, something's not, you know, but
does your voice get that high?
Yeah. Maybe just a little bit. I don't know. I'm in the talkies now.
but talking to Mel and to Joan Rivers, like, because they were still so engaged in everything, it's like, well, that's the secret, you know? It's like they're still hungry, for better or for worse. They still want to know. They want to understand. They want to learn.
Carl was just on Fallon when Jimmy had the show out here. Carl was on. He wrote 3 books this year.
Jesus.
He's 93. You know, no one can read 3 books at 93. and he was still hilarious. He was just hilarious. They're fantastic people.
Well, when is Comedians premiere?
April 9th, 10 o'clock,
right before Louis.
Nice. With a lead-in for Louis. It's a really terrific hour of comedy, I have to say. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it really is, and the show is so unbelievably unique and special, and I think laugh out loud funny.
It is.
And I'm really excited for people to see it.
And Stephen Weber's on the show, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
first 2 episodes.
And I have to say, Megan Ferguson and Matt O'Berg and
Stephanie Weir.
That's our cast, and they are
sensational.
They're
the secret weapon. I mean, they really are. The ensemble of this show makes us look even better, and it really is. We have an all-star cast in front and behind the scenes.
Is Laura Kraft writing on the show?
Yes.
And Andy Secunda?
Yes.
Andy's amazing.
Andy's brilliant.
Yeah, a brilliant improviser. And Laura Kraft is one of the funniest.
And Andy's on the show as well.
Oh, he is on the show as well.
He plays a cue card guy.
Oh, nice.
He's amazing. But Laura Kraft, to me, is one of the funniest, like, in a conversation.
Yeah.
Oh,
she's like
incredible.
A comedy goalie. Like, you cannot get anything by her. She will double down, and you're like, this is really hard. Like, she's so fucking funny.
Yeah, it really is. It's such an incredible group of people, and I can't wait for people to finally see what
we're
working
on. Well, also just the idea, this is going to sound like I'm kissing FX's ass. I'm not. I don't have to. I pitched a show there recently and looked around at the wall in the pitch room, and it's very intimidating because you forget how many amazing shows that they have made across all, you know, The Shield and Justified and Louis and Fargo and Sons of Anarchy. Yeah. And it's like
the Americans.
They're all incredible shows. So,
but it comes at it starts at the top with them. John Landgraf, who runs the joint, is one of the smartest, most articulate men I've ever met. That I've ever met.
It's actually a joy getting notes from them, because you know inevitably they will make it only better, which is a rarity.
Are you saying that because you're being recorded right now?
No. It's actually the truth. We've discussed. It's like every time we get notes, which are rare, it always just helps the product, and it's a wonderful position to be in where you get to work with people who are oftentimes just the best at what they do.
Well, because I'm sure over the years people have said, "Oh, come back and do network television." It's like, it's okay.
I didn't want to be the grandfather who didn't know how to use a cell phone. I didn't want to be the guy who did I say that?
What? Wacky grandpa.
Yeah. Why did I come into this room?
Right.
I didn't want to be that guy.
Right.
I'm me, after all the years and all the stuff I've done, the best part I have is by playing myself.
Yeah.
You know.
That's great.
Well, you guys, thank you so much for thank you for coming and being here on the podcast. It's amazing to have you back again. And I don't think you haven't been on the podcast.
I've never done it.
So this
and I'll never do it again after
what?
The
this
way
was it.
Yeah,
this should be this such a wise guy.
I'm not being wise.
He's terrific. That's why I talk.
Yeah, I'm terrific,
until
Josh.
Until he has me on the Talking Dead.
You can be on Talking Dead.
Then I'm doing this podcast.
You should be
tomorrow.
On At Midnight too. You both should be on At Midnight.
Let's do it.
Have you seen At Midnight yet?
I love that.
It's a stand-up. It's a comedy. It's a game show for comedians. You guys would
love it.
Be incredible.
I saw TJ on there.
TJ Miller.
Yeah.
TJ Miller is always funny on the television program.
I love TJ.
I'm so happy for seeing all the people that are my friends that we're all in sort of the same class. Like the rest of the world discovering
I
how
did a
fucking
pilot with TJ years ago, and I'm like, this is one of the funniest human beings I've ever met in my life, and nobody knew who he was yet.
And it bleeds over into his life. Like the lines between performance TJ and
and
TJ
real
are very blurred.
Yeah.
There's a line.
There's
no line.
There's no line. Well, good. You can come on anything you want, Josh Gad.
Thank you.
And thanks for being here, you guys.
My pleasure.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you.
Amazing. Oh. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah, that was fun.
Such good stories.
Those are I've never even heard some of those stories. Those are incredible.
I made them up.
You did, didn't you?
Knew it.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
What came first? The chicken or the egg? Spoiler alert, it's neither. At Happy Egg, we believe happiness of the hens is what actually came first. Because without happy hens, there would be no such thing as happy eggs. You know, eggs with delicious orange yolks. Those come from hens who are raised the happy way on 8-plus acres of family-owned farms. Choose happy at happyegg.com and look for the yellow carton at a store near you.
Happy
Egg.